Chapter 4. High above the overturned Zodiac, a turquoise aircraft that resembled a winged canoe wheeled in a lazy circle. The broad-shouldered man at the controls rolled the ultralight airplane into a tight banking turn and peered down through tinted goggles, squinting against the reflected glare with eyes the color of coral underwater. His wind-burnished face was creased in a look of puzzlement. Moments before, he had seen swimmers in the water next to the overturned inflatable. He glanced away to get his bearings, and when he looked again, the swimmers were gone. Kurt Austin had been chasing the Zodiac like an aerial motorcycle cop, hot on the tail of a speeder, and seeing the boat flip over. He couldn't figure out why it had gone out of control. The seas were moderate, and no rocks or other submerged objects were visible. Austin wondered if the inflatable or the fishing boat he had seen steaming away from the coast had anything to do with the television crew he was looking for. Probably not. The crew should be on its way to meet the NUMA survey ship, Argo, not heading for this desolate stretch. Austin was aboard the Argo as a deep ocean consultant on loan from his duties as leader of NUMA's special assignments team. The other members of the team, Joe Zavala and Paul and Gamay Trout, had been given different and non-demanding assignments in scattered projects around the globe. NUMA director James Sandecker had insisted that they take working vacations after the team had crossed swords with the hired killers of a mega corporation that wanted to take over the freshwater resources of the world. He had been particularly worried about Austin's attachment to a beautiful, brilliant Brazilian scientist who had sacrificed herself to bring down the conspiracy. The Argo was in the Black Sea, collecting information on wave and wind action for an international databank. With his master's degree in systems management from the University of Washington and his vast practical knowledge as a diver and undersea investigator, Austin had been invaluable in helping to set up the sophisticated remote sensing survey instruments. As the cruise had gone on and systems were set in place, however, his expertise became less necessary. He read some philosophy books he'd brought from his extensive library, but he started to grow bored and restless. The ship seemed like a prison surrounded by a very wide moat. Austin was aware that his psyche had been bruised and that Sandecker had his best interests at heart. But he needed strenuous physical and mental activity, not a cruise ship atmosphere. The serious scientists aboard the ship had been grumbling about the impending visit from the TV crew. They saw them as intruders who would interrupt their work with dumb questions. The fact that they were from a tabloid show on a mission to find Noah's Ark didn't add to their appeal. Austin's outlook was the exact opposite. He looked forward to their arrival as a diversion from his shipboard boredom. The television people had been due that morning, but they'd never arrived, and attempts to reach them by radio were unsuccessful. After lunch, Austin had climbed to the wheelhouse to run an idea past the skipper. The Argo's commander, Captain Joe Atwood, was clearly annoyed at the crew's failure to show up or contact his ship. He'd paced from one side of the bridge to the other, scanning the sea with binoculars. The Argo was supposed to be moving to another station, and the captain was unhappy about the delay. "Any word on our guests?" Austin said, although he knew from Atwood's dour expression what the answer would be. Atwood scowled at his watch. "I think they're lost," he declared sharply. "The next time those idiots in public affairs want me to entertain some crazy TV people, I'm going to tell them to stick their request where the sun don't shine." The captain was in no mood to be told that the job done by NUMA's public affairs department in proclaiming the agency's accomplishments helped loosen the congressional purse strings and attract grants for projects like the Black Sea Survey. "I've got a suggestion," Austin had volunteered. "I'm not busy. What say I take a spin around the neighborhood and see if I can spot them?" The captain's frown dissolved into a knowing grin. "You're not fooling me, Austin. You've wanted to get the Goonie into the air since the day you stepped aboard. It would serve a dual purpose. I could test fly the bird and look for our wayward guests at the same time. And it would be a perfect antidote for his developing case of cabin fever. Atwood ran his fingers through his pale red hair. Okay, pal. Go for it. But keep us apprised of your position every few minutes. I've got enough trouble with those missing TV types. I don't want to chase you all over the Black Sea as well. Austin thanked the captain, and with a noticeable spring in his step, he went down to get the Goonie ready. The ultralight seaplane had been developed as a way to extend a boat's visual reach. The radar that most Numa ships carried could pick up a gnat at 10 miles, but at times there was no substitute for the human eye. Joe Zavala, whose mechanical mind bordered on brilliant, had designed the aircraft. Zavala had asked Austin to take the plane aboard the Argo to test it under real-life conditions, but the ship had been on the go for most of its mission, and Austin had been reluctant to ask the captain for time to make a test flight. The single-seat plane was named after the Goonie Bird, the nickname sailors gave the albatross, a seabird known for its exquisite beauty in flight and clumsiness taking off and landing. Austin inspected the aircraft in its deck hangar. The stubby, ungainly appearance didn't bother him. Austin had flown ultralights before, and what was important were stability and ease of operation. The letters NUMA were painted in black on the side. The flat-bottomed fiberglass hull had an upturned canoe nose, and fiberglass floats supported by aluminum struts hung from both sides of the hull. Attached to the floats and flanking the hull was the manually operated retractable landing gear that allowed the Goonie to set down on waterways or runways. The plane was hauled out onto the deck, and its narrow, 30-foot Dacron-covered wings were unfolded and locked in place. Austin eased into the snug cockpit, and some of the Argo's crew pushed the Goonie down the ship's broad, slanting stern ramp into the sea. Austin started the power plant, threw off the safety line, and taxied to open water to get the feel of the controls. The aircraft handled well on water, and he decided to see what it would do in the air. He pointed the Goonie down an imaginary airstrip and gave it the throttle. Powered by the compact 40-horsepower engine, the Goonie got on plane quickly with no skidding. The aircraft skimmed the wave tops for about 100 feet, then lifted into the air and climbed until it was above the survey ship. Austin circled the Argo once, tipped his wings in salute, then headed on a line toward the Bosporus Strait that connected the Black Sea with the Mediterranean. He reasoned that the TV people, based in Istanbul, would be coming from that direction. The Rotax two-stroke twin-cylinder engine driving the rear-mounted propeller could push the blunt-nosed plane at a top speed of 65 miles per hour. Not exactly supersonic, but the plane handled like a dream, turning, climbing, and diving without a hint of a stall. Austin felt as free as the seabirds he'd seen wheeling high above the Argo in search of scraps from the galley. He flew at about 1,000 feet, an altitude that allowed him to see miles in every direction, cruising at 55 miles per hour. The 5-gallon tank gave the plane a range of about 150 miles. The air was as clear as fine crystal, and the bright sun cast a silvery sheen on the rippled surface of the water. He set up a rough search pattern, running a series of parallel lines that would cover the greatest amount of territory in the shortest time. The TV people had sent a short radio message before they'd left Istanbul, requesting the Argo's position and giving their estimated time of arrival. They said they would be traveling on a fishing boat. Austin saw a number of trawlers, but none appeared to be on a direct course for the Argo. The back-and-forth flight pattern quickly used up his fuel. He was down to a third of a tank, enough to get back to the ship with a narrow margin of error. He checked his compass and was about to turn back to the ship when he spotted the wake of a boat approaching the Russian coast at a high rate of speed. Curiosity got the best of him, and he decided to make a swing close to land. He brought the Goonie down so that he was flying less than 500 feet over the water and had almost caught up with the boat, when suddenly it had been caught by a wave and flipped over. As Austin circled, pondering his next step, he noticed that the capsized inflatable was behaving oddly. Although it was caught in the pull of waves, it was moving toward shore at an angle. Austin picked up his microphone and clicked the on button. Goonie to Numa ship Argo. Come in, please. Argo here. Austin recognized the voice of the ship's captain. How's the little seabird handle? Atwood said. Like a trained pterodactyl. She practically flies herself. I'm just along for the ride.
Glad to hear that.
Any sign of those unbelievable TV idiots from Unbelievable Mysteries? Keeping his eye on the boat below, Austin said, The only mystery out here is an overturned Zodiac. I saw some people hanging on to it, but they're gone.
What's your position?
I'm right off the coast. Austin scanned a craggy point of land that jutted into the sea. I'm looking at some medium-high sea cliffs with a beach and dunes in between them. There's a rock profile on a headland that reminds me of Admiral Sandecker's profile. Beard and all.
I'll ask the navigator. He's sailed these waters hundreds of times.
After a pause, the voice came back.
That's Imam's Point, supposedly the face of an old holy man.
The boats drifted into the surf line. Too rough for me to set down at sea.
What do you want us to do?
I'm going down for a peek. I'm going to need help if I find anyone. The Goonie wasn't made to carry passengers.
We're on our way. ETA in about an hour.
Roger. We'll land and see if I can find a bar that serves a decent Stole martini. Austin clicked off the mic and checked the boat again. He smiled tightly. He hadn't been imagining things. Three swimmers had broken away from the Zodiac and were stroking toward the beach. The ultralight landed best into the wind, which was coming off the water. Austin dropped down to 100 feet and headed toward shore, setting his sights on a long, rolling dune overlooking the beach. He intended to make a U-turn over the dune and bring the aircraft down lightly onto the sand. The Goonie flew over the figures, struggling through the surf. The swimmers were making good progress, riding the crests to save their strength. Austin had a brief glimpse of some low-lying buildings inland, but a brilliant flash of light from the ground caught his eye. The Goonie could turn on a dime. Taking advantage of its quick handling, Austin pushed the rudder control. The plane seemed to spin in mid-air, and he had a clear view of the shallow valley behind the dune. Hidden behind the dune were a dozen mounted men spread out in a single line with swords held high in the air. The silvery red brightness Austin had seen was the sun reflecting off the sword blades. The Goonie's sudden and noisy appearance startled the horses, however, and they milled around in fright while the riders fought to bring them under control. Austin caught only a glimpse of the scene as he passed directly overhead, then he was above the beach again. The swimmers were only moments from shore. Suddenly, pieces of Dacron began flying past his face. The horsemen were carrying more than swords. The wing over Austin's head looked as if a tiger was sharpening its claws in the fabric. Someone on the beach was shooting at him. The thin fiberglass cockpit was no protection against bullets. Even worse, Austin was practically sitting on the Goonie's gas tank. The shots were high, but one lucky round in the propeller would drop him like a wounded duck. He pushed forward on the stick, and the plane dove. Even wearing earphones, he heard the sharp thwack of a bullet striking one of the hollow aluminum struts that connected the cockpit to the wings. He felt a sharp sting on his right temple. A splinter of flying metal had hit him, and blood was trickling down his face. He was wearing a neckerchief, and he pulled it up around his forehead to catch the blood. The same volley that had hit the strut had shattered a fiberglass wing float.
Austin jammed the stick as far forward as it would go, and the ultralight dropped like a runaway elevator and tilted dangerously, the plane thrown off balance by the loss of the float. Austin had to compensate by leaning his weight to one side. He flew out to sea until he was out of range, then put the plane into a turn that took him parallel to the shore. The swimmers had hit the sand on their bellies when the gunfire broke out. Now they were up again and running along the water's edge. He picked out a slim, dark-skinned woman and two men, one short and the other tall. As they ran, they glanced over their shoulders, trying to keep an eye on the goonie, only to see the mounted men crest the dune with swords raised. Spurred on by the new threat, the trio dug their feet in, but it was impossible to run faster in the soft sand. The mounted men would make short work of the defenseless runners caught between them and the deep blue sea. The open expanse of beach offered no shelter. It was a perfect killing field. The horsemen spurred their mounts and galloped along the dune to outflank their prey. Austin reached into an emergency chest behind his seat and pulled out the Orion 25mm signal kit for offshore boats. He fit one of the 10,000 candle-power red meteors into the pistol launcher. Then he cranked up the throttle to full speed. Wobbling dangerously because of the damage, the goonie hurtled toward the beach at 65 miles per hour. The runners dove onto their bellies again as the ultralight buzzed overhead like a large, angry hornet. Austin was operating on pure reflex, more machine than man. Holding the control stick between his knees, he leaned around the curved plexiglass sheet that served as a windshield and sighted on the center of the mounted line. He squeezed the trigger, and the flare streaked toward the horseman like a miniature comet. The awkward angle of the aircraft threw Austin's aim off. The missile struck the dune a few feet below the grassy crest and exploded in a bright scarlet shower. The horses nearest to the fiery burst reared in panic. Those animals that managed to maintain their calm lost it as the plane grazed their heads like a giant buzzing insect. Austin made a quick turn for a second run. The chaotic scene atop the dune reminded him of the famous Picasso mural, Guernica. It was hard to know where the horses ended and their riders began. He smiled grimly and slid another flare into the launch gun. Again, he came in, attacking from the rear this time. A ragged hole surrounded by a lacework of cracks appeared in the windshield. One of the riders had gotten off a lucky shot. Austin felt the bullet whistle by his ear. He made a superhuman effort to keep a grip on his concentration as he aimed the pistol and squeezed the trigger. The second flare streaked toward the confusing mass of horse and human bodies and slammed into a rider with a burst of red phosphorus. He fell from his horse and was dragged off with one foot still caught in the stirrup. The beach flashed by in a blur, and again Austin was out to sea. He came around at an angle until he was behind the dune once more. The grass was on fire, and black smoke billowed into the sky. Riders who had been thrown by their mounts were trying to roll out of the way to avoid being trampled. Others had dismounted and held tightly to the reins as they tried to calm the terrified animals. The horses bumped into one another, and the contact only served to increase their terror. A lone horseman broke away from the others and put his mount into a gallop. Kayla and her friends heard the thunder of hooves and turned to see the rider bearing down on them with sword held high. Austin swung around until he was facing the horseman. He brought up the flare gun but had a problem keeping it steady for proper aim. Instead, he put the goonie into a low dive that took him a few feet above the heads of the runners and aimed directly at the horseman, a big man with a flowing red beard. At the last second, Austin pulled up. The float missed the man's head by inches. The horse whinnied in terror and broke into a wild run. The rider struggled to hang on as the horse took matters into its own hooves, climbed the dune, and chased after the other riders, who had lost their stomach for the attack and were galloping for the woods. Meanwhile, Austin fought a losing battle to keep the damaged plane level. He sat half out of the cockpit, like someone hiking out on an angled sailboat, gritted his teeth, and braced himself for the hard landing that he knew was coming.